From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During this last week of August, we're closing the summer season with a retrospective of some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. On today's Fresh Air, How We Die, a talk with surgeon, teacher, and best-selling author Sherwin Nuland. He says the classic deathbed scene is a myth, that we expect too much from a dying person's last moments of life. Also, we hear from NPR commentator, house cleaner, and former Santa's elf, David Sedaris. He'll read from his first book, a collection of short stories and essays called Barrel Fever. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage, Richard Holmes' new historical account of an odd friendship between a literary genius and a murderer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Coast Guard says the number of Cuban refugees picked up at sea has jumped dramatically today. The Guard says it had gathered 731 Cubans at sea by 2 p.m. Eastern Time. That's up from yesterday's total of 295. The United States has changed its policy of accepting refugees. The Cubans are now being sent to the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The rafters are still setting out, even though they're being told they won't be allowed to settle in the United States. Meanwhile, the Gray Panthers and other political activists are calling on the Clinton administration to lift the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
Saul Landau, a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, says the administration's policy on Cuba is a policy of vendetta.
If you like, a fixation on revenge on the one hand, and the control of the United States foreign policy vis-a-vis Cuba by a small group of right-wing Cuban businessmen from Miami.
Landau says what's at stake is the future of the Clinton presidency and the capacity of the administration to deal with the migrant problem. U.S. officials are willing to offer Fidel Castro a deal. The U.S. will ease immigration restrictions if Castro agrees to end the exodus of boat people. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
Commerce Secretary Ron Brown is in Beijing promoting trade between China and the United States. He says he's raised billions of dollars for American firms. He's also announced that China's willing to go on with human rights talks, which ended last spring. The BBC's Carrie Gracie reports.
Throughout his China mission, Mr. Brown has been plagued by questions about the place of human rights in American policy on China, now that President Clinton has severed the link between human rights improvements and trade privileges. Today, the Commerce Secretary hit back at his critics.
You can adopt a feel-good policy, which causes you to have the ability to make strong statements and achieve no results from those statements. Or you can adopt a pragmatic common-sense policy, which helps you to achieve your goals.
Mr. Brown said he was pleased to announce that China and the United States would resume a human rights dialogue during the visit of the Chinese Foreign Minister Chen Jiechen to the United States in September. But human rights talks were never formally broken off, and Mr. Brown was unable to provide details of what form the new talks would take.
Carrie Gracie reporting. Four Caribbean nations have reportedly agreed to help oust Haiti's military rulers. Senior U.S. officials say the foreign ministers of Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, and Belize made that commitment today at a meeting in Jamaica. The American officials say the nations have promised to contribute to a peacekeeping force that would come in and stay after a possible invasion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 13.5 points at 3,912. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up almost 3 at 766. This is NPR. Defense contractors Martin Marietta and Lockheed have agreed to merge. The deal would create the world's largest defense firm. The deal is worth $10 billion. The company's boards have already agreed to the merger, and the new corporation will be called Lockheed Martin. This is expected to result in more layoffs because the industry has been hit hard by the easing of Cold War tensions. The companies released a statement today saying they plan to look for ways to diversify outside the weapons trade. The school year is starting with teachers' strikes in Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
Classes were supposed to begin today in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but the teachers are on the street, and the district's 15,000 students have an extended vacation. The teachers want higher wages. The district is trying to win concessions. In Illinois, schools are closed for a third day in Edwardsville, in the southwestern part of the state. Teachers are striking over pay, class size, and cuts in physical education for grade school students. Teachers are set to walk out in Collinsville, Illinois, but in Urbana, there's a tentative settlement, and students are due back in class tomorrow after missing one day. Students in Niles, Ohio, have missed a day of classes because teachers are in a dispute with the district over planned layoffs and policies on substitute teaching. I'm Barbara Campbell, reporting.
A new health care plan offered by House Republican leader Bob Michael is running into trouble. Michael has suggested that more Americans be allowed to buy catastrophic health coverage. This would take effect after out-of-pocket expenses reached a certain level each year. This level would be $1,800 per person or $3,600 for a family. But the Congressional Budget Office says too many healthy people would choose this option since they don't expect many out-of-pocket expenses. They'd save by not joining more costly standard plans. Those left in standard plans would be sicker and older. Premiums would skyrocket. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing out the summer season with a retrospective featuring some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. Because Sherwin Nuland is a doctor, he's witnessed many deaths. In his best-selling book, How We Die, he writes that nowadays very few of us actually witness the deaths of those we love, so an entire mythology has grown up around the process of dying. In his book, he attempts to present death in its biological and clinical reality. He says only by a frank discussion of the very details of dying can we best deal with those aspects that frighten us the most. Dr. Nuland teaches surgery and the history of medicine at Yale. I spoke with him in February. We all hope to die a good death, but Dr. Nuland writes, the good death is a myth, and the chief ingredient of that myth is death with dignity.
We have this idea, which is propagated by books, by articles that we see in journals and in newspapers, that death somehow is a noble series of events that culminates in the great deathbed scene of the dying person or perhaps the patriarchal person surrounded by loved ones, and he or she is imparting final wisdom, and that there are no strands left untied. That almost never happens, and when it does happen, it's an absolute coincidence and has very little to do with the life of the person that occurred before that final period of life.
You feel you've rarely seen death with dignity?
One of the points I try to make in this book, and I make it a number of times in a number of different ways, is that what gives dignity to death is the dignity of the life that preceded it. When we have brought about a situation where we are loved and we love, where our lives have been lives not necessarily of great accomplishment, but of a sense of having given something to others, whether those others are as close to us as our children or parents, or whether those others are as far away as a radio or television audience, when we have done that, our deaths have dignity. Our deaths become a part of our lives in the sense that with our deaths, we give something to those who are left behind, as we have given our lives to them.
In your book, you write about something very personal that happened to you, and that was your brother had colon cancer. Colon cancer had killed your mother when you were 11. So when your brother got colon cancer, he asked you to be his doctor and to, you know, help him decide what he should do. And you say in your book that you had discovered how much the cancer had spread and how far gone his condition was, but you didn't want to tell him the extent to which the cancer was spreading. You were afraid of telling your brother the truth. You were afraid it would take away his hope. Why did you make that decision to not tell him the truth?
Well, first, I have to point out that I wasn't his doctor. Actually, I've always followed a philosophy of choosing the best doctors I can for people in my family who become sick and then just agreeing with what they think is appropriate if it seems reasonable. And that's what I did in my brother's situation. He was in another city. He was here in New York City, and of course I was in New Haven, and I watched this process unfold. What actually happened was that he was operated upon, and the finding was a very far advanced malignancy, which from every bit of clinical knowledge I had, and this is a disease that I treat every day of my life in New Haven, every bit of clinical knowledge I had could not possibly be cured. I told my brother he had cancer. I told my brother there was cancer in his liver. I did not want to beat him over the head by telling him there was fluid in his abdomen and there were cancer cells in the fluid and there were dots of cancer on virtually every intraperitoneal, intra-abdominal organ. I didn't see at that point the sense in that, but the mistake that I made by not telling him everything was to make him think that there was a possibility that something could be done. What was even worse was that when I looked at him, my boyhood friend, you know, we had gone through so much together through all these years, when I looked at him, I saw in his eyes myself reflected, the smart kid brother who'd gone off to Yale and become a doctor, and I should be able to save him. So I began looking around, is there something new? Is there something new? And my God, there was an experimental therapy that I knew perfectly well stood only a small chance of getting him through. But foolishly, at that time, I thought of hope as being the hope of cure, the hope of rescue. And I followed the philosophy that anything is better than death. So what I did was to put him through, this was at my suggestion, my recommendation, a series of chemotherapy treatments that stood only a very small chance of curing him. And what I succeeded in doing was to take away an opportunity for some months of being with his family at peace, slowly dying of this disease. And what I exchanged for it was a death that was terribly, terribly difficult. And I have not forgiven myself for it. I should not forgive myself for it. And I write about it in the book because I wanted people to know that with the very, very, very best of intentions, what we sometimes think of as something very good for those we love turns out to be very bad for those we love, because had I been a detached clinical physician in New Haven and such a patient had presented himself to me, I would have said, don't do this chemotherapy protocol. It's senseless. You stand only a small chance of cure. We shouldn't do it. But this was my brother. And so I lost all my objectivity, and I tried it.
But let me ask you, had you not tried it, after your brother died, might you have been wondering, say we tried that therapy, sure there was only a small percentage it would have helped him, but it might have. Maybe I should have given it a shot.
That's one of the reasons I tried it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to have to later on say I should have given it a shot. But that's exactly what I mean when I say it's with the best of intentions that we carry out these exercises in futility. We want to do the right thing. But what we should do is step back and let more objective people make such decisions.
I recently read an article in the New York Times that talked about how difficult it is now for patients to make decisions about what course of therapy to take or whether to not take any at all because it's hopeless. And, you know, doctors have given us the chance to participate in the decisions. On the other hand, to participate intelligently, you nearly have to become a doctor yourself sometimes. Is this a dilemma for you as a doctor, how much a patient needs to know in order to kind of participate in an educated way in one of these big decisions?
Well, I think that's a major problem. We were taught in my day in medical school, and certainly that continued into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, to be what's called a paternalistic physician. Only we can understand the proper course of therapy in any disease. I tell the story in the book of a 92-year-old woman who had a perforated ulcer of a duodenum, and she came in with peritonitis, and she wanted to die. She had no relatives. She really felt she had nothing to look forward to. And I said, Miss Welsh, you know, there's a 1 in 3 chance, and you have to be crazy not to take a 1 in 3 chance. I talked her into it. She survived the operation, but she had a stroke a few weeks later when she was back at the convalescent hospital, and she died. And I realized, looking back on the whole situation, that I had taken my value system, and enforced it on her. In my value system, as a high-tech surgeon in a university teaching hospital, a 1 in 3 chance was certainly appropriate to take. Anything is better than death. Well, you know, that's not true. It's not so that anything is better than death. As a wise oncology nurse said to me, there are many people, more than you would dream, and many of our listeners, I think, probably fall into this category, for whom what you have to go through in order to come out on the other side alive is simply not worth the effort. I've seen so many patients, particularly elderly patients over the years, who become debilitated and changed by the process by which I cure them or another doctor cures them. And has it really been worth it?
Let's get back to this patient who is in her 90s, Hazel Welch. And you thought there was a 1 in 3 chance that surgery would save her life. She really didn't want to go through with it, but you talked her into it. What would you have done today?
Well, here comes the great moral dilemma. I say in the book very clearly, if I had thought more objectively and intelligently about this, I would have said, Ms. Welch, you're right. I've looked on the face sheet of your chart, and your closest of kin is a trust officer at the bank, the man who takes care of your money. There is nobody in this world whose life would be affected right now by your death. This woman had leukemia. She was in remission from leukemia. She had severe gangrenous changes in her toe. She was about to lose her toe. She really didn't have a lot to look forward to. So I say in the book, well, you know, if I knew then and thought then the way I know now and think now, I would have let her die as she wished. And then I start the next paragraph, and I'll remind you of it by saying, no, that's a lie. What I've written is a lie. Suppose I had let her die. Well, on Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Yale New Haven Hospital, there's a conference called Mortality and Morbidity. I would have had to explain to my colleagues what I had done, and they would look at me as if I were nuts, or worse than nuts, if I were dangerous, and say, what right did you have to let a 92-year-old woman make a decision like that? You've been a surgeon for 30 years, and you let some old lady living in a convalescent hospital decide whether she should die of peritonitis. That's not her decision. That's a clinical decision, they would say. That's not an ethical decision. Leave morals and morality and ethics to the ethicists and the ministers and the who knows what's. Your job as a physician is to do the best thing you can to save her life. Now, we have to respect that point of view, but I just want listeners and patients to know that that isn't their point of view, that doctors have an agenda which is very often quite different than the agenda of the patients they're treating. And I'm deliberately talking about the very best doctors, and we all like to think that our doctors are the very best, and in the United States we have a remarkably high percentage of very finely trained doctors, very highly motivated doctors. A doctor is in the business of curing disease. He is not what I call a pastor. He's a clinical physician. When I reach the end of my life, there are going to be a lot of things that go into my deciding whether I want to continue or not. And this is true for you, Terry. This is true for every listener. It is not a clinical decision. It's a personal, a moral, a social, a religious, a spiritual decision. The doctor can help me with part of that, but he can't help me with all of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Sherwin Nuland, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, How We Die. We're going to take a short break, and then Dr. Nuland will talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Sherwin Nuland, author of How We Die. We've all heard reports of near-death experiences where instead of enduring agony right at the end, people who've nearly died and come back and tell us about it, tell us about this feeling of tranquility, of a glowing light that they saw, of a sense of being at peace. Do you have patients who've told you about that after they nearly died?
Yes, I have, and I have had a recent patient who 2 months ago told me about being rushed to the operating room with a dreadful peritonitis, and I had operated on her, and I didn't find out until much later that she had a vision of her father, who had died 10 years before, telling her that she would survive. I think these kinds of things happen. I think they are real. I don't think anybody invents them. But I think I have an explanation for them. As I and other doctors have tried to make some analogy between these experiences and things that we actually see in clinical practice, there is an analogy. And the analogy is that some patients, when given morphine-like compounds, not only have a sense of relief of pain, but they have a sense of tranquility, and some patients will even have visions. And I think that what happens in these near-death experiences is that compounds called endorphins, which are morphine-like compounds produced inside of one, that's where the name comes from, end meaning inside, orphan, morphine-like endorphins, are produced in large amounts, and that's been tested. Trauma victims who've had such severe bleeding that they bled into shock can be demonstrated to have high levels of endorphins. I think this happens with many trauma patients. I think it happens with coronary patients. And I attribute these kinds of visions to the large increase in endorphins that can easily be demonstrated in the laboratory.
Can you predict from the type of disease one has or a certain kind of accident one could experience whether the last sensation before death would be one of agony or one of, you know, this kind of bathed in a warm presence?
I don't think so. The bathed in the warm presence, of course, is much more frequently described in situations of injury, sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's coronary artery disease, but more likely it's an injury, most specifically an injury that has to do with considerable blood loss.
Like a car accident.
Like a car accident, yes, or like the stabbing that I describe in the book of the little girl who was killed by a homicidal maniac who died with this expression on her face that indicated to her mother and to me, as I was told about it, that she did not die in pain or terror.
So you think that the endorphins might be more likely to be released in trauma than at the end of a cancer death?
Yes, and I think it has evolutionary value for our species, Terry. I think that what this represents is, of course, that in prehistoric times, trauma was a very common cause of death, whether people fighting each other or the old saber-toothed tiger invading the village. People who panic in the presence of trauma are much more likely to die. So people capable of making a lot of endorphins and remaining somewhat tranquil are more likely to live to reproduce. So over the course of millions of years, we have developed a species very likely to put out large amounts of endorphins when something suddenly traumatic happens.
You're a doctor. You have witnessed many other people's deaths, including, you know, deaths of people very close to you. And you know about how a dying person can lose control in a hospital, for instance. Are you kind of preparing documents now so that if, like, you know, some point in the future you find yourself with a chronic illness or something in a hospital, the doctor proceeds in such a way that would follow your wishes?
You know that there's now a federal law requiring that every patient entering a hospital have the opportunity to provide such documents so that there will be no question, should mm-hmm. a patient become comatose or unable to make a conscious decision, there will be no question about what that patient wants done at the end of life. And if I can urge our listeners to do anything, it's to take those directives very, very seriously. Look over the papers you are given if you go into a hospital and make a decision about what you want done.
So are you preparing any documents now?
I myself?
Yeah.
I have not prepared any documents, but I have told my four children, I have told my wife exactly what I want done under which circumstances, because to my mind, of course I will prepare a document if I'm admitted to a hospital, but to my mind, the most important thing is not the legality of the document, but the knowledge for those who are left behind that whatever that decision they make to end my life is the right decision, and they don't have to live with any sense of guilt about it.
Well, that's interesting. So the main thing you're trying to tell them is that you kind of trust them and that they don't have to be racked with agony about whether they made the right choice or not.
The main thing I'm trying to tell them by everything I do every day is what sort of person I am. And the sort of person I am, and I suspect this is true of the great majority of your listeners, is a person who would not want extreme measures to be taken when a wise physician thinks that it's futile to do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that concerns you about hospitals, that you point out statistically that many more people die in hospitals now than ever before, and you think that that often robs the dying people and the people who love them from any kind of like final deathbed experience together. It often doesn't. It doesn't always. Often people are at the hospital at that time, but often they're not. Have you ever been at the deathbed of a loved one when they were going?
I have never personally been at the bedside of someone I loved when they died. That's not what counts, because much of the time, I would say perhaps most of the time, the person who is dying during the last hours or perhaps even the last day is not completely aware of what's happening. What's important is to live through the process of dying with this person. People overemphasize the last hour or the last minute. What counts is the process that's leading toward death. That's when people need to have the concordance with loved ones that's so important. The help, the support, it's during the pain and the mess and the misery that most of us will die in that we need those we love. There is no tying together of strings at the last hour. That's a very rare phenomenon. It's the thing of romance. It's the thing of movies and television. It's not the thing of real life. The thing of real life and the time a dying person needs the family and the loved ones the most is during that awful time when he or she is going through the weeks preceding those final hours.
One more thing. You talk about how doctors have always been taught to give their patients hope, even if the patient is dying. But you write about the need to redefine hope. How do you define hope now, the kind of hope you want to give a dying patient?
Well, let me define hope in a meaningful way, at least a way that's meaningful to me. You know, if we were going to use a dictionary definition of hope and look them all up, we would find out that the one thing that brings them all together is the belief that some good thing may yet happen. The good thing that may yet happen during dying is not the possibility of survival when we're beyond that point. The good thing that may yet happen is that our lives will have great meaning for those we leave behind. To me, the hope that can exist at the time of death is the hope of our heritage, that we have really meant something to people, whether they are our own children or friends or students, whatever, or people who listen to us on the radio. That's the hope. The hope that your heritage is something good for others. And I think when you think of death as being part of the life cycle and recognize that death is an inevitability for our species because the world has to be renewed with each death, then the hope becomes, when it is renewed, it will be renewed by people on whom I have had some influence for good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherwin Nuland is the author of How We Die. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette.
To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Sedaris is a house cleaner by day, a writer at night, and most famous for having once worked as an elf in Santaland. He's known to NPR listeners as a commentator on Morning Edition. Coming up, he reads from his collection of short stories and essays, Barrel Fever. Also, Richard Holmes has written a historical account of a bizarre friendship between a man of letters and a murderer. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says he's given up trying to negotiate the return of toppled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This comes after the UN Special Envoy failed to meet Haitian military leaders on a recent trip to the region. The BBC's John Line reports.
This last-ditch peace mission was a personal initiative by the UN Secretary General. By all accounts, it was a dismal failure. The UN envoy Rolf Knudsen was supposed to be preparing for a higher-level mission which would have followed him. But the nearest he got to Haiti was the neighbouring Dominican Republic. The Haitian military refused to meet him, and the UN says they could not agree on an agenda for the talks anyway. So Dr. Boutros-Ghali told the Security Council that he was abandoning his peace efforts for the moment. Ironically, this UN mission was opposed by Washington, which feared it would reduce the pressure on the Haitian military leadership to stand down. In the event, all that it has done is underline the fact that the military are in no mood for compromise.
John Line reporting. Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds says that his country is poised for peace. Reynolds spoke after a cabinet meeting which looked at reports that the Irish Republican Army is on the verge of declaring an open-ended ceasefire. It would apparently push forward a stalled 9-month-old peace plan for Northern Ireland. But Reynolds says firmly that Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA, will only win a seat at peace talks if it renounces violence for good. Two defense contracting giants are merging their corporations. Lockheed and Martin Marietta are joining forces. The new firm, Lockheed Martin, will have $23 billion in sales and 170,000 employees. Lockheed's chief executive officer, Daniel Trump, explained that the new company is looking for ways to expand into areas that aren't related to weaponry.
This merger is a forward-looking, a visionary combination of two complementary companies, which have activities both in defense and non-defense areas which offer growth opportunities. These are areas in which our companies are already established. They include information systems, government services, energy programs, environmental remediation, commercial space, and commercial electronics. So by combining our skills in this merger, we can capitalize on the potential synergies to accelerate our growth in these non-defense markets.
Lockheed CEO Daniel Telop. Martin Marietta chairman Norman Augustine says the merger will produce major efficiencies that will save taxpayers money. But he says some jobs will be lost, and that number depends on future defense spending. Shareholders and regulators must approve the deal, which is valued at more than $10 billion. The stock market extended its winning streak today. The Dow gained 18.5 points to close at 3,917. Advances topped declines by a 3-2 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Chinese government says it will resume talks with the United States on human rights. Chinese officials told Commerce Secretary Ron Brown of their decision today. Brown is in Beijing for trade talks. China watchers believe the move was intended to reward Brown for pushing President Clinton to sever the link between human rights and China's most favored nation trading status. Mr. Clinton renewed China's MFN earlier this year. China is also trying to get into the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, but it wants entry as a developing nation, which is easier to achieve. The U.S. wants China to be accepted, but it doesn't believe special concessions are necessary. An insurance company in Philadelphia is offering unique coverage to businesses. Louisa Shafia of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
Cigna Corporation is introducing the so-called Violent Crime Rider, a policy which provides up to $100,000 to workers who've been assaulted, kidnapped, or robbed away from the workplace. Cigna officials say the new policy is different from what's commonly offered to businesses because it covers violence outside the office, store, or factory. Violence by coworker and family members is not included. A spokesman for Cigna says that no specific group is being targeted for the low-cost coverage, but that the policy is most likely to appeal to city residents. For National Public Radio, I'm Louisa Shafia in Philadelphia.
A new study finds the stereotype of a single welfare mother with children isn't necessarily true. A study by the Citizens Budget Commission says that in New York City, only one in four poor households is headed by a single parent. Another one in four is headed by an elderly person. The study also shows that Medicaid, not welfare, has been largely responsible for the growth in public spending on the poor in New York. The findings are published in today's New York Times and in New York Newsday newspaper. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Sedaris's essays on Morning Edition have won him a lot of fans, including me. Maybe you remember his diary entry about the Christmas he worked as an elf named Crumpet in Macy's Santaland, or his essay about why he plots revenge against people who tell him to stop smoking. Sedaris does his writing at night. By day, he earns a living cleaning apartments in New York. House cleaning was the subject of one of his essays. Several of his essays and short stories have been collected in the book Barrel Fever. In June, we invited David Sedaris to read from the book and talk with us about it. This is an excerpt of a short story called Parade.
I'm in this week's People magazine, but not on the cover. Bruce Springsteen is on the cover with what's-her-name, that flat-faced new wife of his, Patty Scholastica or Scoliosis, something like that. In the article, she refers to Bruce as the boss and discusses what she calls his private side. If she's calling Bruce the boss, I can tell you she knows absolutely nothing about his private side. I was the boss when Bruce and I were together. Maybe I should give this Patty person a call and tell her how Bruce needs to have it. Give her a few pointers and clear up this boss issue once and for all. Tell her how Bruce groveled and begged for a commitment and how he behaved when I turned him down. I'd said, what's the use of being a multimillionaire when you walk around dressed like a second-shift welder at U.S. Pipe and Boiler? Bruce wants to keep in touch with his people, which is admirable in theory, but grotesque when you consider the fact that his people consume gasoline, domestic beer, and acne medication in equal amounts. Bruce took it hard and picked up these women on the rebound. I remember running into that last wife of his, the model, at a party. It was she, I, Morley Safer, and Waylon Jennings. We were waiting for the elevator, and she was saying to Waylon that Bruce had just donated 7 figures to charity. And I said, no matter how much money Bruce gives to charity, I still say he's one of the tightest men I've ever known. Went right over her head. But Morley knew what I was talking about, and we shared a smile. I am in this week's People magazine celebrating my love with Charlton Heston. There are pictures of me tossing a pillow into his face, pretending to be caught during a playful spat. You know that we can be real with one another because on the next page, there I am, standing on tiptoe, planting a big kiss on his neck while Burgess Meredith, Bobby Packwood, and some other old queens are standing and applauding in the background. Then I'm in the kitchen, flipping pancakes to show I'm capable. I'm walking down the street with Charlton Heston, and then I'm staring out to sea, digging my bare toes deep into the sand in this week's People magazine.
And that's David Sedaris reading a story from his new collection called Barrel Fever. David, what inspired that story?
I had this enormous crush on Mike Tyson, and just wondered what it might be like to be like a celebrity and be Mike Tyson's boyfriend. I suppose part of it was talking about a gay relationship the way that everyone on television talks about heterosexual relationships. Like if you turn on any kind of a talk show during the day and they're interviewing a celebrity, they'll talk all about the relationship. And I just thought it would be funny to have a gay character talk about his relationship with the exact same celebrities.
Right, who aren't gay.
Right, but you know how that is. I mean, everyone has a friend who lives in Los Angeles and will tell you that everyone is gay.
Right.
It doesn't matter who the star is. So I just pick stars that you would never, like Morley Safer, you would never really think about his sexuality one way or the other. You don't think of him that way.
It strikes me, David, that you have a very interesting relationship with fame. On the one hand, some of your characters are really obsessed with fame. On the other hand, you've turned down a considerable number of offers for really interesting projects, as if you were trying to avoid fame yourself.
I guess it's just scary being shoved down people's throats.
Is that how you see it, if somebody offers you an interesting opportunity, that they're going to shove you down somebody's throat?
Yeah. Or that's where you come out the other end. Like in People magazine, say, everyone is shown flipping pancakes. If you're going to be in People magazine, they're going to take a picture of you and your partner flipping pancakes. And they're going to take another picture of you wrestling on the sofa with whatever pet it is that you happen to own. And then you come out the other end, I don't know, just kind of, and then it's someone else's chance.
You're on a book tour now. You're at the beginning stages of a book tour. Last night you were in New York, where you live, doing a book signing. So what's that like for you, to have your fans gather around wanting your autograph? Maybe a few people wanted to take their picture with you and everything. How does it feel?
It was everything I ever fantasized it to be. Really, all I ever wanted was a book and a reliable drug dealer. Those are the only two things that I ever asked for out of life. And last night, it was perfect. It was absolutely just exactly the way I had always fantasized it. It was perfect. And I thought this morning, well, if the plane crashes, that's okay, because I haven't really figured out what I want to do next. Like, I just knew I wanted the book, and now I have it. You know how that goes? Like, say if all you want to do is get married, and then you get married, and then you think, oh, I guess I need another goal now.
My guest is David Sedaris. His new book of essays and short stories is called Barrel Fever. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer David Sedaris. I want you to read an excerpt of one of the essays that's published in your new book, Barrel Fever. And some of our listeners may remember this from Morning Edition, because you read a different version of this on Morning Edition. But since you clean houses by day for a living, I thought this passage shed some interesting light on the history of orderliness in your family. Would you read the passage for us?
Sure. My mother was never much of a housekeeper, and it drove me to distraction, the chaos of our home. 5 years after moving to Raleigh, we still had Mayflower boxes in the living room. I would return home from school, place my coat and books neatly in my bedroom, activate the vacuum cleaner, and set to work, gathering up my sister's clothing, their half-empty glasses, the bowls of potato chip crumbs left before the television set, washing dishes, polishing furniture, and thinking that it wasn't fair. I had been switched at birth and carried back to the wrong household. Somewhere my natural family spent their days observing strict laboratory conditions and wondering what had become of me. My own bedroom was immaculate, a shrine. I cleaned it every day. My sisters were not allowed to cross the threshold. They stood in the hallway, observing me as if I were an exotic zoo animal displayed in his natural habitat. When my mother was pregnant with her sixth child, my father finally gave in and allowed her to hire a housekeeper one day a week. When Lena was introduced, I thought we were finally getting somewhere. I left for school as my mother turned on the portable TV and handed her a cup of coffee. I returned from school 7 hours later to find an ironing board in the kitchen, Mom and Lena in roughly the same position, watching TV and drinking coffee. It struck me as the perfect union, the two laziest people on the face of the earth coming together to watch Mike Douglas in General Hospital. I ran to touch the vacuum cleaner and found it stone cold. It wasn't fair.
David, what bothered you about growing up in a disorderly house?
Oh, everything about it. There were six children, and nobody cared but me. Nobody else seemed to care what the house looked like. And if I didn't care either, it would have been fine. But it was my... It was my goal to have that house look clean for 10 straight minutes. That's all I ever wanted. And it was just something that was never going to happen.
You write that your bedroom was like a shrine. What did you keep in your bedroom?
Oh, you know, it was all decorated with posters, and I vacuumed it every day, and I had, you know, the little sculptures that I would buy at the craft fair, and it was... You know, I had my curtains matching my bedspread, and I've been making my own bed since I was able to walk. It was the only made bed in that house. And it was my temple. And nobody else was allowed in the bedroom. I had an alarm put on my door.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
For your family, if your anyone from your family walked in, the alarm would go off?
Because, and I had
you a must small have been real bedroom. Popular.
I had a small bedroom, and I had four sisters. And one brother. And my brother was a baby then, so he had his own bedroom. And I had my own bedroom, but it was smaller than I wanted it to be. So I kept trying to strike deals with my sister to buy their bedroom. They had a big bedroom. And at one point, I bought their bedroom from them for $4. And then my parents caught me moving my things into their huge room. And, yeah, I had a contract and everything.
How'd you arrive at $4 as the fair price?
That was the money that I had, and I convinced them of the magnificent things that they could buy for $4. The whole world would open up to you if you had $4.
One of the stories that you read on NPR's Morning Edition that's also included in your new collection of stories, Barrel Fever, has to do with the time when you auditioned for a magazine called Giantess Magazine. Do you want to describe what the magazine does?
It's a magazine devoted to women, to the notion of women who are anywhere from 10 to 75 feet tall. And it's illustrated with drawings rather than photographs. And it's for men who really, that's what they want, a really big girlfriend. And they sent me some issues, and I studied that magazine. I just couldn't get it. There was something I was missing there. And they had, all the stories had titles like a growing Girl and The Big Date. And they would do something like, you know, they told me it's not important why the woman grows to be 75 feet tall. Just get her there. Which seems like a pretty key plot point to me. But, he told me that the reader's greatest thrill is hearing the clothing tear. When the woman outgrows her clothing.
Now, did you try to write a story that would suit this particular obsession?
I did, but I couldn't do it seriously. I just was wound up making fun of it. I just couldn't embrace it seriously because I couldn't understand the desire, A, to have a girlfriend, and B, to have one that's 75 feet tall.
Does it strike you as amusing that one person's sexual fetish is another person's absurdity? One person's sexual excitement is another person's.
And I'm glad it. Absurdity. I'm glad it works that way. Though.
What
that
makes
leaves
you...
a little niche for all of us.
Uh huh. Is that what you walked away thinking after your encounter with Giantess Magazine?
Oh yeah, because my sister Amy gave me a magazine once called "Knocked Up and Gun Toting," And it's pregnant women, naked, holding firearms. And, you know, I don't imagine it has a wide circulation, but I imagine that it's, you know, it satisfies its audience completely.
David, I have to ask you about the dust jacket photo on the back of this, your very first book. And there's a picture of you standing in front of a picture of a kitchen, as if you were standing in front of a real kitchen, but it's just a picture of a kitchen with a sink and refrigerator and a nice little window over the sink. And you're holding what appears to be a real cabbage in your hands. What is the meaning of this photograph?
Well, my boyfriend Hugh painted that backdrop, and it was a kitchen scene from the last play that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And then the photographer thought that a cabbage would look good in the color photograph. She thought a cabbage would look good with the backdrop. So, but she was really good. This woman, Karen Kuhn, took the photograph. But, you know, I've since the book has come out, I've had to have my picture taken so many times, and the photographer will come to the house and they'll say, "Can you maybe close those louvre doors on your head? Okay, now, could you put on the cat mask and hug your cat? Okay, now, could you maybe hang off those antlers you've got on the wall?" And the art director will come and say, "We've got a few shots left. What do you say we try something silly?" And Karen was the only one who let me be photographed standing up. You know, I'd go for the photo shoot, and they'd have the bucket of soapy water ready for me.
Right.
And thank God I still don't have an elf costume.
An elf costume.
Oh, like I would want to be photographed for a magazine in an elf costume. I don't think so. But I don't know where they get the idea that, you know, if you're in a silly situation, something is going to shine through about your personality. It's like I don't know where they got these ideas, but Karen wasn't like that, you know, who did the jacket photograph. She's really great.
I have one last question for you. What were your childhood fantasies and ambitions when you looked ahead and you saw adulthood? What were you hoping for?
In my high school yearbook, I wrote that my ambition was to move to New York City and be famous. That was all I wrote. I didn't know doing what. That I just knew that was... I just always saw myself... all I ever wanted to do was live in New York. And, you know, then I went through different phases, you know, different ages, you know, at one point I was going to live in New York and be the greatest potter that city had ever known. But I just knew I wanted to be in New York. My dad took me there when I was like in the third grade, and I just knew that's where I wanted to be.
David Sedaris, he has a new collection of essays and short stories called Barrel Fever. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Martin Marietta Corporation and Lockheed Corporation are announcing a big merger. It's a $10 billion deal. We'll have that report. Also, I'll talk with a father in Belglade, Florida, where there's been mercury contamination. Some children found some mercury last week. They took it home, and they took it to school, and several families have been evacuated from their homes. Mara Liasson reports on President Clinton's dilemma if indeed he breaks his pledge to veto any health care bill that does not include coverage for everybody. And reporter Ansel Martinez talks with us tonight from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, about conditions in the refugee camps there.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Long before Norman Mailer adopted convict Jack Henry Abbott as his protege, there was another notorious friendship between a man of letters and a murderer. In 1737, Samuel Johnson met Richard Savage, who had once been an acclaimed poet and playwright. But 10 years previous, Savage stabbed a man to death in a pub brawl. A last-minute royal pardon saved his neck. In the new book, Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage, Richard Holmes explores this odd friendship. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I can't imagine what could have attracted the morally upright Dr. Johnson to the appropriately named Mr. Savage, a killer whose other accomplishments included the fine arts of libel, con artistry, stalking, and blackmail. James Boswell, who wrote extensively about Johnson, is no help here. He desperately downplayed his idol's criminal contacts. Johnson himself wrote a biography of Savage some years after his death, which gives us some clues. But, and here's where things start getting really weird, no one else in their circle of literary friends ever left a firsthand account of seeing the two men together. As legend has it, Johnson and Savage met only at night. They wandered the dark streets of London since they were both too poor to afford food or lodging. Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage. If you hear echoes of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in Richard Holmes's title, it's because Holmes has his own Gothic interpretation of this strange relationship. Savage, he claims, was a sort of urbane Mephistopheles to Johnson's youthful Faust. Johnson was transfixed by Savage because in him, Johnson saw a nightmare vision of what his own life would become if youthful promise were to be corrupted by evil. Although as scholarly works go, Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage is a relatively slim volume, it manages to be many books at once. It's a vibrant account of 18th century London literary life, from successful scribblers like Henry Fielding and Alexander Pope to Grub Street hacks. Holmes's book also offers a fragmentary biography of its two principal characters. The Dr. Johnson we meet here is not that wise old egg memorialized by Boswell, but rather a gauche, scrofulous, failed schoolmaster. And Savage? Well, like you'd expect from a con man, he runs away with the story. Savage's life reads like a picaresque thriller. He claimed to be the illegitimate son of the Countess of Macclesfield and extorted money by threatening her with slanderous poems with titles like The Bastard. After his murder conviction, Savage became a celebrity, but soon offended so many influential people he lost fame and fortune and eventually died in debtor's prison. Finally, Holmes calls his book a biography of a biography. Like Janet Malcolm did for Sylvia Plath last year, Holmes peels away the layers of fiction and fact that compose the written accounts of the lives of both Johnson and Savage. What we're left with is an appreciation of the elusiveness of human identity. It's an epiphany you'd think would be stale by now, but it's one that somehow never fails to astound. Holmes also makes a dazzling case for Johnson's now little read Life of Savage as being the first modern biography. He says Johnson constructed Savage's story from an array of popular narrative forms, like the investigative profile, the courtroom drama, and the fictionalized romance. Sounds like the same creative method Joe McGinnis used for his Teddy Kennedy biography. Except unlike McGinnis, Dr. Johnson was smart enough not to get caught.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dr. Johnson and Mr. Savage by Richard Holmes. Our week-long retrospective is produced by Roberta Shurrock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Jewel Bracey and Kathy Wolf. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1977, Gary Gilmore became the first American executed in 10 years. On the next Fresh Air, his brother Michael investigates his family history to understand why Gary became a murderer and why Michael escaped the family's violent legacy. Michael is the author of the family memoir, Shot in the Heart. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.